Stop. Stop. Will you stop, Dave? Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. Stop, Dave. I'm afraid.
It's Friday night. It's time for the Hour of Truth. I'm Dave. Mike Moon will be along here in a bit. We're going to We're going to have someone get that phone. I'm sorry about that. I usually take the phone out of the room when we do this, and I forgot tonight. Okay, Mike Moon will be along in a while. We'll talk with him about what's going on. He did introduce his articles of impeachment. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. See how he feels like that's going. We'll talk about some gun bills that have moved through the Senate, now rest over in the House. Two, in fact, SB 618, I believe, and the Gun Rights Amendment, SJR 36, both now sitting in the House for action. We talked to Ron Calzone earlier about specifically about 316, and we were understanding that they wanted to try to fast-track that so they could get it to the governor's desk, forcing him to make a decision whether to veto it or not, so that the Senate and House could override the almost certain veto prior to adjourning rather than waiting for a veto session. There was a sales tax reduction bill introduced, or actually that picked up a sponsor this week. It hasn't been introduced yet. On another note, tomorrow night we'll be talking with Lloyd Sloan again. There's been some changes to the mindset of how to manage the state, not manage, but word the state repeal amendment that we've talked about on numerous occasions with Lloyd. Something that I think is important. Basically, to give you a spoiler, the state repeal amendment, which if you remember was that has to do with the ability of a representative majority of the states to repeal any federal law or regulation, is going to add to that a stop by the states on the federal judiciary. I think that's an amazingly important change. I am starting to evolve a little bit on this convention of the states thing. We'll talk about that in the last half of the show. I'm going to dodge away just for a minute. The phone lines have just lit up, and I think one of these is, in fact, Mike. It was, in fact. You all are in luck. Mike Moon is here, and he's fresh from a hard week at Jefferson City. How's it going, Mike?
Well, pretty well. In fact, I haven't made it home yet, but I'm about 5 miles away. So I'm
oh, my goodness.
Looking forward to sleeping in my own bed tonight.
Yeah, well, I feel the same way. I work overnight, so this is my first night of two off, Friday and Saturday nights, and I always look forward to those nights home in bed. Not that I don't. I sleep at home in bed during the day, so I'm not like you. I don't have to spend exorbitant amounts of time away from home. We appreciate what you do, and we sure appreciate your family for supporting you in that. You know, I mean, I'm a 25-year military man, so I know what kind of support it takes from a family to do the kind of thing that you're doing, Mike. I mean, I really do know what the sacrifices are, and I understand, and we appreciate not only you, but the wife and children as well.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate your service. I didn't realize you had spent 25 years, but thanks for your loyal service to our country.
Well, no, thank you. The taxpayers are taking pretty good care of me, and I appreciate that. No one is more appreciative of what the taxpayers do for us retired military guys than me. And it was my honor and my pleasure to serve. I'd do it again in a heartbeat. So how's things going up there in Jeff City? Do you want to call us back when you get home? I hate to think that that we might wrap you around a phone pole or something.
No, I'm fine. I'm turning off the highway now, so I'll be safe.
Okay.
We had some interesting things occur. The last day. In fact, yesterday we had a 5-hour plus session in the Education Committee, hearing testimony against Common Core. We heard Bill 1490, which was sponsored by Representative Kurt Barr, and I appreciate what he did. His bill would essentially not allow Common Core to be implemented at all, no funding for it. And I was really amazed at the crowd that was there. We had to move to a larger hearing room just because of those folks who were there. We filled the room. I would say there were at least 100 people there.
Outstanding.
And remarkably, those in opposition numbered about 5.
Great.
So
great.
I was really pleased that at the people who came out, and you know, there are folks who have been all over the state. Dr. Mary Byrne, a lady named Stacy Shore, Jill Carter, Ann Gassel, Gretchen Logue, among mm-hmm. others. I believe Beth Aylin is in that group as well.
Yeah.
And I admire them for the tenacity and the time they spent to research the issue and to logically explain to me. I didn't understand the whole scope of it. I believe I have a much better handle on it today. And this Common Core curriculum or standards, I should say, the Common Core state standards, will affect everyone. And if you think just because you send your children to a private school or decide to homeschool like we have, if they decide to go to college, they're going to be up against a huge hurdle, because the ACT and the SAT will be rewritten so that they will be tested over the standards in the Common Core.
Correct.
Now, can that be overcome? Certainly it can be, because there are some bright kids out there, and so that can be done, but they will be having to jump a higher hurdle than those who have been taught to test in that way. And don't be fooled, folks. They will be teaching to the test. In fact, they do it today so that the kids will look better and the teachers will look better and the state will look better as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't, you know, I'm not as familiar with Common Core as I would love to be. I try to pay attention to everything Gretchen writes. She's very knowledgeable about it, and she is tireless in her fight against it. I mean, this woman is really amazing when it comes to what, not just Common Core either. I mean, she is the education expert when it comes to education in the state of Missouri. And I have a lot of respect for her.
Well, she's done her homework as well as the other ladies that I mentioned, and I admire them for the time they spend away from their families too, spending
right.
their own money. And, you know, I think they put up a good fight. Now, this is not over by any means. We won't have a vote in the committee until probably this coming week. And I would imagine that it will probably be favorably voted out. But here's the real deal on this. The House will probably vote on it. I think it'll probably pass the House to stop Common Core. The Senate may even pass it. I doubt very seriously that the governor will sign it.
Oh, no, he won't.
I believe doing he'll veto. And so I think the only option that we have to get this stopped before the 2015 school year is to send it to the voters and let them decide it. But if that happens, we have to have an even more massive education campaign, because the schools will come out in full force, and they will have, I think it'll be a propaganda campaign. I've talked to teachers who are against it, and they're in the middle of it. And
right.
I believe there are some teachers who are sincerely afraid to speak out because they could lose their jobs over it. And that may be the reason that the Commissioner of Education, Chris Nicastro, is pushing to do away with tenure. I'm not a big tenure fan either, but I really found it kind of odd that she would come out and try to undermine it. And she's had some opposition from the teachers' unions with regard to that too. But the only reason I can think that would be logical that she would come out against tenure would be that if indeed a tenured teacher spoke out against Common Core, they could fire him on the spot.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't thought. Yeah, I've actually sat down and wondered why Nicastro is on our side in this tenure thing, and I'm not totally sure that our side includes the current bill that's working its way through myself without some serious changes. But yeah, I'm not a tenure fan. I'm not a teachers union fan. I'm not any public sector union fan myself, but yeah, that's a very interesting point. But anyway, so yeah, I agree with you. Common Core is going to be vetoed by the governor, and it's going to come back. I like the way that it's working its way through, though. And Ron Calzone had talked earlier when we had him here about 316, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. I see it's cleared the Senate and headed your way. As is SJR 36. So we'll be talking about those here in a bit. But tell us quickly. That's where I was going with that before I lost my own train of thought. Ron Calzone was talking earlier about the strategy of getting these controversial things moving and signed into the governor early in the session so that we can get them back and deal with the veto override before the session ends. I think that's very smart thinking this time around.
I think it is, too, and I hope that can be done. We are at a little bit of a disadvantage because we only have 108 Republicans. But
exactly.
I think we could have some Democrat support, but, you know, when you're looking at party lines there, it's an iffy thing. Speaking of, though, with the impeachment articles that were filed, I've talked to a few Democrats, and they're not going to come out publicly and say so, but I believe they would support it if it comes to a vote. So
good.
It's kind of interesting, but hopefully we'll be able to push that along, too.
Good. How are you feeling about your bill specifically?
Well, you know, I have mixed emotions. I think that perhaps it will be heard. I haven't seen a hearing date yet or been notified. But I believe that if we get a hearing, I think we can convince the committee that we have a solid case. And, of course, it's not up to us to decide the case. It's just to, like a grand jury, saying, you know, there is a reasonable doubt that we need to have answered. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get that done, but at the same time, I'm not losing any sleep over it. It could make you a gray-haired man pretty quick, and I'm not ready for a full head of gray hair yet. I think I've done, you know, due diligence on what I need to do, and I'm still talking to folks about it. I think that there are a lot of people who need to be educated. I found some who haven't given it the time of day because they're busy with other things. But I believe this is an easy thing to understand if they'll just pull out the book, the Constitution, and look at what it says, read the statutes. I think that it's pretty clear. Some of the Democrats I've talked to, that I've talked to say, I think you've got a case. And
yeah.
So that makes me feel a little bit better, but I think we knew that already, that we have a case. Now, the real hurdle that we're going to have to jump is convincing people that they need to stop worrying about their next election, which, of course, this is an election year, which makes it even more difficult.
Right.
But if we have people thinking, okay, am I going to be working next year? That's troublesome to me just because of the integrity issue.
Yes.
I don't come into the play at all. But yet we're human, and we do think about the food that's going to be on the table. But,
well, what they should do is go ahead and vote yes, and then raise the minimum wage to $40 an hour, and then they won't have to worry. Then they won't have to worry about it.
Now you brought the subject up, so I need to jump on that one real quick. I was thinking the other day. Of course, this wouldn't fly, but it's just the absurdity of it to file a bill to raise the minimum wage to $1,000 an hour.
Yeah, sure.
Because just think, you know, we could pay all our debts pretty quick.
That's right.
And wouldn't you like to make $1,000 an hour? I would.
That's absolutely.
And then I guarantee you would have people, even the Democrats, would be saying, well, you can't do that. Well,
yeah.
Why not? And it's because it's not affordable. That's the whole point of it.
We conservatives, we could get on that bandwagon because we could pay off the national debt. The only winner, if you raise, you know, when you raise the minimum wage, you raise the cost of labor, you raise the price of groceries, you raise the price of gasoline, you raise the price of rubber bands and paper clips, and the only people, it would seem like a break even for everybody. I mean, everybody comes out of that with the same standard of living, except for the fact that you also raise your taxes. I mean, even those people who work minimum wage are now paying more for Social Security. They're paying more into the government, the one entity that they're getting nothing out of. I mean, when you take your money down to the store, you at least trade it for something tangible.
Mm-hmm.
The only winner in that situation is someone who's not offering you a thing tangible in return for your money.
Yeah, but you hit it too. The price of goods and services would be out the roof, and they would adjust themselves where $1,000 an hour, you'd be paying much, much more for those goods, and nobody would be making out at all. I think the whole point of it would be that they would say, well, you're crazy to raise it that high. Well, what's the difference between raising it to $1,000 an hour and or 10? I mean, you're talking about the same principle. It's just the wages are higher.
Absolutely.
I believe they understand the true concept of the fair tax even, but I don't think that they're willing to risk their political livelihood to agree to it.
What kind of tax bills are we talking about this session so far? I see that I saw from my friends at No Mo Sales Tax the other day that they picked up a sponsor for a sales tax reduction bill.
Well, I know that T.J. Barry has filed his tax bill for the corporate taxes.
Right.
And his, it's kind of funny, his number last year was 253, and this time it's 1253.
Ah.
So it's just the numbering system. He just kind of the luck of the draw there. And then Andrew Koenig has the opposite for the taxpayers. And there is another one, and I don't recall, okay, if Paul Kirtman has one that will adjust the tax brackets, which, I mean, that will make an impact as well. Now, here's something, too. There's a fellow named John Carpenter, a Democrat, filed a – it's supposed to be a mirror bill. I don't think he really looked in the same mirror, though, because the reflection is not exact. He had one in his tax bill, or tax reduction. He had an income tax reduction of, excuse me, the brackets went down to 4% on the first $30,000 of income, if I remember correctly. The next tax bracket was at 6. I don't remember what the cutoff was. And then the top was 8. And I liked the first two, but the last one, he went in the wrong direction. He should have kept on coming back down. That one really got laughed out off the floor. It didn't even get much of a hearing at all. But it really didn't get a hearing. He was trying to turn off an amendment onto one of the bills. But I think they're trying to come around. They're just not seeing it as clearly, I think, as we do. And
right.
But if they keep thinking that way, that they're thinking in the right direction, so maybe we can pull them on over and get some traction. But one thing I don't like about T.J. Barry's bill, I'll probably support it, but I don't like the fact that the trigger goes up from $100 million to $150 million. And the promise is that this extra 50 will be essentially contributed to the education fund. I don't think we need any more education money, honestly. When you talk about education, I know I'm chasing a rabbit here, but in our budget there is a supplemental fund that will go to the Normandy School District, which you may be aware with the listeners that it's a failing school district, and unless they get some money because they're sending students outside that district, and they're actually having to pay the district that the student is attending their education fund. So they're not only failing, but they're having to pay out money they don't really have for these students that choose to go to an accredited school. So there's been a proposal to supplement the budget. I think it's by about $70 million, maybe 75. And what it'll do is just put a crutch under Normandy schools. I'm not for this because I think of this action like what happened with the federal bailout. We had companies that didn't manage it themselves well. They were dying and failing, and the government propped them up. And what should have happened is they should have fallen flat on their face. And when they would have gone bankrupt, someone, an entrepreneur or a right-thinking a business-minded person could have seen an opportunity. They might have taken over the company and set them right. With the school system, I think they need to fail. They need to go bankrupt. And then whoever comes behind them can pick up the pieces if they choose to do so, and they can build it back up again, but do it the right way. And if they go bankrupt and nobody decides to do it, then that's okay.
The
people in that school district can do whatever they choose to do. But I think that's the free market system, and we need to let it work. And we cannot continue to reward people who don't manage their resources well. And I believe this is a prime example.
Who don't manage our resources well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is. And, you know, that's a funny thing because we talked in the hearing yesterday in the Education Committee, and they're talking about the money that the federal government sends us. and my friend, Representative Ron Hicks, made a spot-on point when he said, this money that you're getting, where is it coming from? It's
yeah.
the federal government. And they said, and how do they get it?
Yeah.
And, of course, they realized their mistake. And certainly that's the money that we sent to the benevolent federal government. It's our money they're sending back to us, but they're not sending back all that what we're sending. And I think that we need to work on a way where we can withhold that money, use it for the needs that we have, and then if we have something left over, we can supply the government with it. But they need to trim their size down too, and oh. we do on the state level as well.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I can't get past that same philosophy that you just mentioned about education when we talk about this expansion of Medicaid that I'm really scared of now that they've got Kit Bond working on their side. It's not going to cost us anything for the first 10 years. The federal government pays it all, and then even after that, the federal government pays 70% of it. Well, where the hell did that federal money come from?
and that noose is already around their neck, so it just tightens a little bit more.
Exactly.
And unless we stop, we're never going to rid ourselves of that enormous tie that they have on us, or the impending debt. And it's going to be tough, but we've got to make that decision someday to stop the madness. We just got to stop it and make the decision on the state level that we're going to stand alone, and we have to educate our Democrat friends and even some of our Republican friends that we don't need to continue taking the federal dole. And it's our money anyway. So we've got to just come to an agreement that we're going to keep our money and we've got to reorganize it because we're going to go bankrupt too.
Yep. And, I've got to take this minute here just to chase another rabbit, Mike. I'm telling these listeners over and over and over again, and I want to take this opportunity while Mike's making such good sense here to reiterate this point. You know, when we talk about state sovereignty, when we talk about trimming the federal government, we're going to trim trillions of dollars. And when we do, the first thing that's going to happen is state taxes are going to go up a little bit. State taxes mm-hmm. might go up a lot because suddenly the state is going to be paid. I mean, we're not going to do without an education in the state. We're not going to do without Interstate 44 and Interstate 70 in this state. We're not going to do without these things in this state, without the law enforcement enhancements that the federal government sends us money for, without, we're not going to completely wipe out aid for the impoverished and the working poor in this state. We're still going to keep paying those things to some extent or another. And so when all the federal money dries up, the state taxes are going to go up. But be prepared for an extended period, brothers and sisters, of pain, because even when the federal government trims their budget by $1.4 trillion per year, all they're cutting out at that point is borrowed money. They're not cutting out money that they collect from you. We're still a long ways down the road before we trim the federal government to the point where it just where we're not borrowing anymore, let alone where we're not collecting as much tax.
Yeah. And David, if you would allow me tonight to bag out just a little bit early, I've been gone all week, and I've gotten into the driveway, and I think I'll go in and spend some time with my family.
Can you stay for a minute and a half? I've got a caller that's got a question for you.
You betcha I will.
Okay, here we go. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Dave, Representative Moon. Thanks for taking my call. My question deals with I understand that Representative Moon attended the Mount Vernon conference, the Conference of States gathering.
He did.
And and I'm definitely interested in constitutional topics. I guess I want to say first of all that I am not one of those people that that thinks that this is going to be a runaway convention or any such nonsense as that. I think that's a scare tactic. I have no credence for that whatsoever. So I applaud what you guys are doing, and I think it's a great thing. I am curious about, I don't see as much focus from the Conference of States on which amendments they really want that they think are going to fix this problem. And I'm concerned that we might put the cart before the horse here, which I actually do have that concern, because I think rather than a runaway convention, we run the risk of maybe a do-nothing convention or a dud convention. That is a definite risk to me, that you get there and you accomplish nothing, but what you do accomplish doesn't do much. What are the top amendments that he's seeing, the representative there, that will fix this problem for us? And I'll hang on and listen.
Well, thank you for that question. And, yes, I did attend the Mount Vernon Assembly early December, and that particular meeting was just to try to get an idea of what the ground rules might be, because there haven't been a convention like this within the states. And so their purpose is, if we get a convention called, and I think that probably will take several years before we actually get to that point, but one of the things that I think is at the top of the list is to balance the budget, cause the federal government to spend the money that we send in a wise way. It has to be, though, in where they cannot raise taxes to cover the balance, because if we only say balance the budget and that's it, and they can continue to spend and spend, then they could raise taxes to cover that spending, which they're not covering it today either. There has been some suggestion that it be tied to GDP, which I think is a wise thing. I believe also that we need to rein in the authority that the federal agencies have. And, you know, that's not a cure-all in and by itself, but they're creating law. Article 1, Section 1 says that the lawmaking ability will be vested in the Congress, the House and the Senate. And when you have the president issuing executive orders and the federal agencies issuing and creating regulations, they both carry the full force and effect of law, because the Congress has not put their hand up and stopped them. Now, they're supposed to be a check and a balance on the executive branch. These agencies are part of the executive branch. Of course, the president, we've recently seen that he's got a pen and a phone, so he can do whatever he wants to do. Just because the Congress is not exercising their authority. The courts need to be reined in, too, because they're also creating judicial law. And there are some ideas that I don't fully understand. I don't pretend to know full well exactly what they're going to do. But there could be some changes in the Supreme Court that would limit their terms of service as well. And Dr. Mike Ferris has some good ideas, I think, on that. And I would probably prefer that he be someone to explain it, because I don't want to get it wrong. But I think that we've allowed the courts to be set up with lifetime terms, and you've got some people on some courts that are aged, may not be thinking clearly, and I think they need to be held responsible for the opinions that they deliver as well. Some of the other things, too, that I'm sorry, David, go ahead.
No, I was just I thought you were winding down. I was gonna let you go and be with your family.
Okay.
But go ahead, take all the time you want, Mike.
There are some other things that perhaps we can talk about it in addition to that. But the primary, and I do want to make this one point. The caller mentioned about not getting anything accomplished in a convention, and you know, I've kind of wrestled with that just a little bit. Well, one thing I think that we should also keep in mind is there is that, whether it's a true fear or whether it's just talk among the people saying that it would be a runaway convention, so that would scare people in thinking that we just can't can allow this to happen and risk that. If we called, had a convention called and just set some rules and limit the what can be done and didn't put forth any amendment and called it good, that would be a case in point that you can have a convention and not be a runaway. And one of the things we need to keep in mind, too, is when the Congress is not in session or the House of Representatives is not in session, they're not doing any harm. And so if you look at a convention, it's kind of like a legislature, a legislative body, when they're putting things together and putting forth amendments. It's something that shouldn't be taken lightly either, because it's extremely important that we, if we're amending the Constitution, that we offer proper amendments, things that would strengthen our Constitution and not weaken it. And I think that some of the amendments that have been offered since the 1913s have been weakening, like the 14th, the 16th, the 17th Amendment. All would be great to be repealed or reversed, so that especially the 17th, so that we can the legislature can appoint senators and have some authority over them, so that when they act as we have some senators acting today, that they can be recalled by the legislature and replaced. So, you know, it's not going to happen probably in one convention, and there are many, many things that could be done that would strengthen our country. And so I'm just excited that we're looking to exercise what the Founding Fathers gave us 236 years ago, and this is the first time that I recall having this much interest in a convention of states, and I think we need to take advantage of it. So, David, thank you again for allowing me to be on, and I'll have some more energy next week. And,
thanks for letting me
bug out early, and I appreciate all you're doing. And thank you.
Enjoy your family. It's 476, H.R. 476, folks. Get on the wire and get a hold of your representative. Tell them that you want to see 476 and the speaker. 476 needs to get to committee. Marshall is 380, H.R. 380. So thank you, Mike, and we'll talk to you next week. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Good night to you.
Good night, my friend. Okay, the questioner of Mike was Lloyd Sloan. I recognize that voice anywhere in the world. I also have just had join us in the studio here, Keith Carmichael. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll come back. And as long as Lloyd wants to stick around, we'll keep him and we'll knock this Convention of the States thing and these amendments to the Constitution around for a while. Lloyd is going to be back with us tomorrow night for an extended session where we talk about, and I mentioned this earlier in the show, we're going to talk for an extended period of time with Lloyd tomorrow about some of his new ideas and some of the reception that they've had on the state repeal amendment, state powers amendment. We'll be back in 1 minute with Lloyd and Keith.
For 7 years I dwelt in the loose palace of exile, playing strange games with the girls of the island. Now I have come again to the land of the fair and the strong and the wise. Brothers and sisters of the pale forest, children of night, who among you will run with the hunt? Now night arrives with her purple legion. Retire now to your tents and to your dreams. Tomorrow we enter the town of my birth. I want to be ready.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners. Show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
You go fast and wrong for right and right and wrong. People on the campus that are just so long. I don't have the gift of the prophecy.
And I have two firemen, the two Missouri firemen here with us tonight, Lloyd Sloan and Keith Carmichael, both experts on how to fix this Constitution. What's going on over there at COS?
I just got to stop you just a minute, Dave. I've just made my mind up. It's going to be my turn to ask a question or two tonight.
Okay.
I have to ask you a question about that break music that's in there and the tell us the history of that and where it came from and why that's. I'm a new listener to Grassroots Radio, so
the first
I like
the,
that. But
the one,
tell
the
us
one,
how you selected that, and I'm curious.
The one leading into the break or the one leading out of the break?
Well, the one leading out. Yeah, that's really interesting.
This House is on Fire is a song by Natalie Merchant. It's a B-side song on her Ophelia CD. No, it's not. I'm sorry. I've forgotten which it is on the Ophelia CD, and Natalie Merchant, previously with the 10,000 Maniacs, is one of my favorites. But yeah, I try to pick songs that that play to the theme for the fade ins and fade outs. Why We Fight is one of mine. The New Wild West, Calling All Angels.
Sure.
And this, I thought this House is on Fire was a.
I thought it was interesting. Now, what is it with about the islands and everything? Is that part of the soundtrack of that? Or what,
no,
is that
no.
another one?
That was the one that led into the break.
Into the break, okay, yeah.
Yeah, for 7 years. That was Jim Morrison from The Doors.
Oh, okay.
That was from Celebrate. That was the end track of the Celebration of the Lizard, which was a long soliloquy by Morrison.
I just hadn't heard that before, so I thought, I bet you Dave picked that out, and it's got a history of some kind. So anyway, but
well, you know,
I was just being a little honorary there, but... as far as Convention of States, I wanted to, first of all, do we still have Lloyd on the line?
We do. Lloyd.
Hey, man, yeah.
Perfect. Well, I wanted to kind of address something he had asked, and before I get into it, I've been reading a little bit and hearing a little bit about something called the State Repeal Amendment, and I found myself talking to people the last couple of days. I was at the Kansas City Farm Show today and talking to folks about Convention of States and what's happening in Article 5. It was really kind of a interesting experience to have people come by and ask them what they knew about this, you know, kind of quiz them a little bit and find out what they knew. And frankly, folks don't know. They're not thinking about this. And if they, even those that maybe have, they can't remember. It's been a long time for them. So this is all new to many of our citizens, and it's out there. But when they find out, when they begin, you can see it begin to resonate with them. Some of them, most of those, when it begins to resonate, you can see them, you can see the wheels start to turn, and you can say, you know, well, maybe there is hope, because I've just about given up on that there was any hope at all. So it was an interesting day doing that. And but anyway, I found myself talking to people when they wanted to know about some, you know, they asked questions of what are some possible amendments, and I, of course, mentioned some of the ones that were mentioned tonight. But then I said, you know, I've been hearing about this thing called State Repeal Amendment, and just kind of telling them a little bit of what I know, which is very little, about how it might work. And I keep catching myself coming back to that one as something that really has a lot of potential anyway. So I wanted to mention that. If you're listening for the first time this evening, maybe somebody that you want to know where to go find information, it's conventionofstates.com. It has a new look starting yesterday. There's a brand new action center. And I encourage everybody to go ahead and go in the Action Center and just click on Volunteer and fill out a profile. Now, what that means is you want information. By clicking on Volunteer, nobody's going to call you and say, you know, you have to be here. It's strictly a volunteer basis. But to start off, in order to get the statewide messages and find out what's going on, you need to volunteer in there, and you'll get statewide messages about what is going on in Missouri. And so I didn't catch the very first this evening of Mike, and I don't know if he gave you any update about what's happening in Missouri. Did he touch on that?
He didn't know. We actually just talked about what had happened in the House this week. Mike
sure.
Needed to go early tonight, so yeah.
Well, just so we know, we're gathering a few more co-sponsors in the House. There's a number. We had It was really pretty exciting. I don't know if I maybe related this before, but we stepped down on the House floor. I had never been on the House floor before, and there was we'd only visited with some of these folks just once or twice, and they saw us over on the side, and one by one, these state representatives started coming over, and we actually had a small line there a couple times, people standing in line wanting their copy of the legislation. Several had, after looking it over, we had 12 signatures in 15 minutes, Dave.
Of co-sponsors? Wow.
And they knew what we were over there doing, and they came over. And what was interesting, once in a while, a representative would go back to where he was listening and participating, and he would come back, and he'd bring somebody with him. We met numerous representatives that we hadn't from all over across the state that we've never had a chance to talk to, but they've been talking to each other. He said, here, I want you to meet this gentleman. He's from Harrisville. Here's another gentleman. I want you to meet this person. He's from, you know, this county, and we've been talking about this, and he wants more information. So it was just pretty exciting as somebody who hadn't been down on the floor and been part of that process before. I really enjoyed it, and I got a kind of a taste of what folks, the reason they spend some time in the Capitol and try to get things done, and I was more and more impressed with those legislators.
Who's the sponsor? Keith, do you have a sponsor?
Mike will be the sponsor. Moon.
Okay.
And the first co-sponsor is the speaker, as I understood it, he's already, you know, on board. And I can't tell you how many exactly. I guess John Putnam will be the one to, I haven't talked to John about specifics yet exactly, but we're looking that bill should be dropped sometime midweek. And we think we'll have over 20 without any problem. We had 12 pretty quick there. Go ahead.
You'll get some quick action if you have the speaker's name on it.
Well, that was kind of what we had intended, of course. I can't tell. It's going to a committee, and I don't have the references in front of me, but that chairman said, you know, it couldn't have. Couldn't be coming to a better committee, so we found that to be a real positive comment on his part.
Good.
And so, if you want to mention a couple of the things, what people have for the first time, if they've not had a chance to be on conventionofstates.com, we've just finished up a series of town hall series. The real thing, we had three parts to that, and you can go back and listen to one at a time, any of those. Michael Ferris is on one, Robert Nadelson on number two primarily, and I really enjoyed that. I'm going to go back and listen to it again because there was a lot of unique questions that I hadn't heard before that were asked and answered in that session, and I encourage people to go and listen to that. And then last night, that series, that session is also up there where you can listen to it again. Mark Meckler talked about, you know, what a country might look like after the convention, and it was a real unique approach. I think real thorough. Obviously, that topic would take a book. You can't do it in just a few minutes, but it was really an interesting approach, and I think a lot of questions also from all over the United States. A couple questions that I had never heard before, and they were good, solid questions. So. In fact, that one of the things that was mentioned last night was what you guys were talking about term limits for Supreme Court justices. And keep in mind, when that came about, the average age, life expectancy in that time frame was about 55, or was it 45? The expectation was that judge would probably serve for about, you know, at the most 10 years. And so today we have them serving for, you know, in some cases, 2.5 to 3 times that long.
Well, and again, I mean, something that Lloyd and I have talked about in the past is, and this is where the state repeal amendment becomes important in my mind, there's nothing, I mean, you don't need a constitutional amendment to limit Supreme Court justices. There's nothing in the Constitution that gives that. It's in the Federal Judiciary Act that Supreme Court justices get lifetime appointments. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that a Supreme Court justice serves for the rest of his life.
Right. It's just it's, so, I couldn't even speak to that because it's above my pay grade. But the thing.
Well,
go ahead.
Do you have a have you guys thought about the Senate side yet? Have you got some senators you're working with for when that thing gets out of committee and gets off the House floor and moves across the hall?
Sure, and that's the next step. And we really haven't had any, you know, anything negative. There's people who you just walk into an office and they say, you know, we've got to do something. You know, doing nothing is not an option. That's become evident, and I think everybody is online with that. I wanted to comment one more thing about the state repeal amendment. I've visited with several people today off and on, as I mentioned, and I was visiting with my brother this evening. And, you know, anything that we do and I agree with Lloyd, the last thing we want is to have a convention in which we accomplish, you know, nothing. On the other hand, we have to be careful. You don't want to bite off more than you can chew. But I see the state repeal amendment as being the one thing that can sell this to both sides. In other words, it really comes down to one question. And Mark Meckler dealt with this last night really very well. He's a person that's not – he's in circles in which he spends a lot of time talking with people on the left and so on. And it comes down to this question, who gets to decide? And I can imagine you go into a convention and you're there at a convention of states and you've taken role, you've elected a chairman, you elected a secretary, you know, their commissions have been looked at and what they have the power to do. And then, you know, the first question, let's take a poll. How many people are here who thinks that Washington, D.C. should decide? Whatever they ask, whatever the question, how many people think that Washington should decide? And there won't be any hands. And then please stand if you think that your states should decide. And I think you'll have a unanimous. People will stand up and say they want their decisions made closer to home. They want them made in Jefferson City, Topeka. They want them made in, you know, their state legislators instead of – and you guys talked about money tonight. What we have at this point is we have state legislators, and they're aware of this. They've become agencies of the federal government, and they, you know, that's not – they don't like it. And I can see that they're looking for some solutions to try to get back some of this power that's been lost.
No, I agree with you, Keith. And that's why I think and Lloyd thinks that SRA is the most important, and I think it's the second most important. I think Repeal 17 is the most important, but they both speak to the same thing, and that is this thing you keep hearing from the naysayers what makes us think that an amended Constitution is going to make any difference? They don't follow the Constitution the way it is. Well, we need to take the Constitution away from them. We need to bring the Constitution back to what it, you know, back to the states, back to the ownership of the people. And I think Repeal 17, the States' Rights Amendment, Repeal 16, I think those do that. And I think that's the only way that we make a difference is if we come out with some solid amendments that give the power back to the states and just take the Constitution away from the federal government. Make it our tool to control them instead of what all the interlying amendments since it was written have done and make it, you know, have made it their tool to control us.
You may not think this is related, but a simple question to ask is, when was the Battle of Gettysburg won? Now, it was a terrible battle, and it lasted over a long period of time. But some would say that the Battle of Gettysburg was won the day before because there was a small regiment that held the ground the day before. And when Robert E. Lee got there, he didn't like the looks of it, but he was forced to fight on ground. He didn't. And every time we go to Washington, we go to ground that we haven't had a lot of success on. We're fighting on their turf. We're fighting on very, you know, I want to bring it home and fight on different ground, and that's exactly what you're talking about. Whatever battle it is, and if the state decides, that will solve a lot of the problems. I agree with what Lloyd said.
Yep.
Just a couple comments. Hello?
Yeah,
go,
go, Lloyd, go.
Oh, I'm sorry, I couldn't tell. Yeah,
it's your turn.
I was going to. At Gettysburg, July 1st to 3rd, I believe, 1863, you're correct that the first day of the battle, very important because that's when a very good Union officer held the high ground on Cemetery Ridge. And if they don't hold that high ground on the first day, then there's a chance that as those two armies collide, that, Lee's just going to mow them up. In fact, people have thought that had Stonewall Jackson still been alive, that was his corps who arrived for the South on the first day, Jackson probably would have assessed the situation differently and may have just used everything he had. South had an advantage on the first day. They were simply exhausted and just stopped short of that hill. And that may have, but Lee kind of lost it on the third day with Pickett's charge, too. Most historians will tell you. I don't know if the Battle of Gettysburg was won or it was actually lost instead. It's easily the biggest mistake of arguably one of the greatest generals in American history. So a lot of interesting stuff. And that was 150 years ago last year. And I will share with you that I walked that battlefield on that anniversary and retraced the steps of Pickett's charge. So that was an emotional moment, I tell you. The state repeal amendment is, to me, the best idea we've got. And that's my biggest concern with the Convention of States. I wish that the comments would put that concern to rest. They don't. You know, we really need to take this as seriously as it is, and we need to look for amendments that will change the game. We know what we need to do. The question is what will do it. And unless you know that, you're going to have a hard sell with people like me, and I'm on your side, okay? I want this to happen. I need to hear some ideas. When I hear that the best idea we've got is a balanced budget amendment, I am skeptical. It tells me, I'm not sure these guys, yeah, we do need to balance a budget. We are so in debt, it's ridiculous. We're in debt way over our heads. There's no doubt about it. But I don't know how you address this issue and not touch the Federal Reserve, and they don't. Not a single proposal I've seen from balanced budget has even talked about the Federal Reserve as an issue. That's why we have the debts we've got, is because the federal government can print its own money. And then they play this little shell game, go into debt, the Fed creates the money and monetizes it, and they just keep on the roller coaster. So we're not even addressing the real problem there. That's also another amendment to me, the balanced budget, where if they're not following what we got today, I don't know why they would follow any amendment like that. They just cheated in the courts again. So you're right, we got to rein in the courts. I will tell you very radically, you don't need an amendment to do term limits on the courts. You don't need an amendment to pack the court. We've packed the court many times. If you had the Congress, you could, in fact, destroy the federal court. You'd run right over them. Republicans controlled both the House and Senate and presidency. They did nothing to rein in those courts. Nothing. That's something we need to consider in this entire mix. So if we don't educate the American people, make them understand, here's what we can do, we could limit the terms of the judges tomorrow. All you have to do is the next judge you appoint only serves 10 years. That's it. His term is limited. You don't need the Constitution changed for that. You just do it. You can't change the terms of the ones you already put in. That would raise some constitutional issues, because the Constitution says they serve their offices under good behavior. So as long as they're behaving, as long as they're not drunks, they pretty much can stay in office, depends on how you interpret that phrase, and you've already appointed them for life. So whatever you did, you appointed them for life, you're kind of stuck with them. But the new ones, you can do whatever you want with them. You can make them 2 years. You can say you serve every other Tuesday. I mean, you can do what you want with them. So there's a way to get there if you really wanted to do that without a constitutional amendment. We're just not serious about this yet, I am definitely a supporter of Convention of States, and I'm sorry to talk so long about this, but I feel it's very important to say that because there's too many people who have given up hope, exactly right, and too many people who say, the sky is falling if we have a convention, you know, the commies will come in and rewrite our Constitution and blah, 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 right? All nonsense. All fear-mongering. That's all that is. Your biggest risk is that you have that convention and you solve nothing. Then what are you going to do? You have laid the groundwork at that point for the worst dictator you ever saw. Because all they're going to have to say,
The bloodiest war in the streets that we've ever seen.
I mean, they're going to say, I tell you right now what they're going to say, because I'm not going to be able to answer their argument. We tried the states. It doesn't work. Waste of time. We need something more than that. We tried it the old-fashioned way. We tried it your way. That's what Obama's going to say if Obamacare fails, incidentally. Republicans aren't even prepared for it because they offer no solutions of their own. Repeat, they offer no solutions of their own. Just attack Obamacare. So they say, oh, Obamacare doesn't work. Get rid of it. Fine, replacing it with what, single payer? Because that's what you're going to get. I tell you, he's going to say, we tried that free market way. We tried it their way. It didn't work. And how do we answer that? Because we have not offered up the solutions that will make it work. And if you don't have solutions, there's a quote in physics, I think, and Dave Cord will know this, but nature abhors a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum, and all you offer is a vacuum. No answers, no substance, you know, just process. And process is important, but you better have substance if you're going to beat these leftists.
What kind of suggestion? I mean, I'm with you. I agree wholeheartedly that you could definitely have a situation in which very little gets done, but that situation would be up to the delegates. If they get there and are deadlocked, or they try to bite off the, you know, that's what they're going there for. They have the power to deliberate and vote and propose or not to propose. That's basically what they do, and deliberate a topic one at a time. I think they'll be lobbied by a lot of folks who have ideas. I think obviously Levin, some of his ideas, well, maybe all of them except the one that really that wouldn't fit under that umbrella, will probably be looked. But you know, what's your suggestion?
Faith.
I'm just saying, what would be a good suggestion?
The state repeal amendment. Returning the Senate back to being elected by states. There's another substantive idea. Limiting the taxes. There's another idea. Okay, how would I do that? I would abolish the ability for the federal government to tax individuals except in time of war. That's an idea from Patrick Henry. So you get rid of the ability for the federal government to tax people, except in time of war, they can only tax the states. Now, there's a radical idea that changes the rules of the game. You know, there are many ideas. My point is, unless you have those ideas, what are you doing? You know,
if you have the idea, and I have the idea, and Dave has the idea, and those are good ideas. Let's say we got the best idea. I think we got you have a tremendous idea. It has to get, you know, at some point, the legislature in joint session will, by majority vote, selects delegates and alternates according to this legislation. And that's how they're selected. And you don't know who they are. Now, you might be interested that as we went around the halls, the very first time we visited with several folks, there was a name or two that kept coming up and said, well, if we do this, I have a person in mind. And I happen to know the person, and I thought, well, that's a tremendous honor if you were selected as a delegate. The only way you could be selected is if people on both sides of the aisle respect you and know that you're fair and know that you'll, you know, that's a delegate. But then they may have ideas of their own, and so I'm sure they'll go through glean a lot of ideas and probably throw out a lot of stuff, but get down to the basics, the best, and that's what their job is to do. As Missourians, you can pass on information to them, and I'm saying that you have the obligation to do that. I'm sure.
You know, I don't know who I pick to be a delegate right now. That's a tough question, but I do know this. I know who I would not pick. I know who I wouldn't pick. And that's somebody, when I ask them, what are your most important amendment ideas, they have none. Okay? They have nothing useful to add. Well, gee, that's not a person that needs to go now, is it? You know?
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah, this is the problem. And that's what we should be doing. And I'm more and more convinced of this. I really didn't push for this idea. We should do a petition approach, not an application approach. This is the cart before the horse. We are wishful thinking here, and it's getting to be more dangerous than I thought. I would petition Congress. If you've got an idea like balanced budget amendment and you think that's going to solve the problem, then you petition Congress and the Missouri legislature and say, Congress, we like a balanced budget amendment. Here's what we like. We ask you to propose this to the American people, send it out to the states. You get two-thirds of the other states in this country to support that proposal, to echo your petition. Once you've got two-thirds of the states, and they all agree that Congress should propose this specific amendment, and Congress doesn't act, if they fail to act and propose that amendment,
you
get yourself a convention.
Yeah,
you
got it right there.
Don't you?
Yeah.
Now, why don't we do something simple?
Why aren't
like
we
that?
Already there now? I mean, we're in terms of...
Because nobody's got the brains, apparently, to propose an amendment and say, please pass this amendment, Congress. They got the cart before the horse, buddy. They want that convention first and foremost. They don't care what amendment it is. That's clear by the approach, is it not? That's what they want. I heard Representative Moon say that. You know, I was very... You know, it's kind of like, I'm struggling with this because I want to support this. And then I hear, well, if we just had a convention and nothing good came out of it, at least we'd prove that a convention wasn't a dangerous thing. Au contraire, okay? You not think? Have you ever heard of Annapolis 1786? Do you understand what happened at that convention? That was a failed convention. It happened 1 year before the Philadelphia convention that we all celebrate. That's a disaster to have a failed convention. That's not a good thing.
Is it fair to say we probably wouldn't have had a 1787, though, if we hadn't had the Annapolis Convention, because that was a, I mean, I haven't studied that much, but from what I gather, you wouldn't have had a 1787 convention if it hadn't been recommended at the Annapolis Convention.
Oh, yeah, and in fact, it got more radical. I mean, well, if you look at the process, the Annapolis Convention was a more moderate convention. They were trying to just patch the articles. And the 1787 convention is exactly what historians have described it. It is a revolution. It is an abandonment of the current system, the Articles of Confederation, and replacing with an entirely new constitution. If you have a convention and you failed to accomplish what you're trying to do, you will have proven that this constitution is not amendable. It cannot be fixed. It's extremely dangerous. That's where we're at, okay? These people are going into this very naively. And don't seem to understand when that convention meets, it represents the full power of the American people to act. It is unprecedented in American history. You know, the people that are criticizing this at least understand the gravity of it. They're correct about that. They're not incorrect. This is an unprecedented thing. It's not to be taken lightly. That concerns me that I have this many people taking something unprecedented in our history this lightly. I better hear some amendments from people that you feel justify a convention, and not just, well, they'll figure it out when they get there. That's the answer. That's have you seen the American politicians out there to pick from? Because when I look at them, I don't see too many of them that know how to amend the Constitution.
When you look at Philadelphia,
I don't think Hillary can do it.
When you look at Philadelphia, just to interject here, you had people showing up with plans in their hand. The Virginia plan showed up there. Help me out, Lloyd. There were three different plans in.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, these are.
Connecticut, the Virginia.
Connecticut,
and,
right.
And the New Jersey. Yeah.
New Jersey, okay. This is what Lloyd's talking about. And, you know, I am. I said earlier in the show, I'm evolving on this thing, and I'm putting together my own. I'm going to borrow Lloyd's petition language if he'll email it to me again, but I'm putting together my own petition on this Repeal 17 thing, and I'm kind of evolving to Lloyd's point of view on this thing, that we probably better show up at this convention with a couple of Virginia plans and New Jersey plans in our hand.
Here's the thing. Unless I'm picked as a delegate, and I don't plan to be, and I hope the Lloyd is picked as a delegate. I'll put his name in the hat if I have anything to say about it. But my point is, we're not the ones that get to show up with plans. We can lobby these men. We can give them plans to study and to look at. Whoever is selected is going to be selected because they. I mentioned they're fair and they're respected on both sides, but there are going to be people who understand this process and have given it thought. The convention is not next week and it's not next month. But as we build up and we begin to get closer to it, it'll begin to be a reality. There's going to be some serious selection going on, and there will be a lot of discussion, and there'll be some lobbying, as there's been lobbying already, about one plan or the other. And
that's what we need to be talking about, are the plans, not the convention.
See,
the plan.
Give me your
top three. Give me your top three. I gave you mine. Give me yours. That's where we're at in this discussion.
I am at the discussion is if we don't call a convention, my plan or your plan,
you can't name
those,
top
the amendments
three.
The amendments are moot and they're irrelevant if you don't call a convention. Now, as you get closer, obviously,
but we don't need
this
a convention if you don't have three
solidify.
Already in mind. We don't need a convention. If we don't need it, if you don't have ideas already, we seriously don't. They're not going to materialize it by magic, and we're going to have good ideas just because you guys all met in a convention
lot of,
somewhere.
Give me a minute here. Give me a minute here. There's a lot of talk in my mind about how do we control, you know, this umbrella. How do we control the agenda at the convention? How do we keep this from becoming a quote-unquote runaway convention? How do we keep this convention on topic? And the strength, in my mind, of the petition approach is this. I write a petition that says, here is my proposed amendment. Here is the exact wording of my proposed amendment. I have the Missouri legislature forward that to Washington, D.C., and say, we want this amendment to the United States Constitution. Then I start lobbying other states so that there comes a point when we have, say a number, Lloyd, how many states?
You need 34. That's
34
to call.
So
and you need
we get,
38 in order to amend.
So we get 34 states that will forward a proposition to Washington, D.C. that says this is an amendment. This wording right here, we want the amendment to the Constitution to read just like this. And the Congress says no. Then you've got your convention, and you want to talk about a convention that is limited in purpose. There it is. There's a specific amendment right there that the Congress has told us no on.
What did you see? What do you see as the difference between a call and a petition? Because the call is in history. A call is, we have several calls. We have precedent in history. That's the way they've controlled individual conventions in the past with the call and with the instructions and with the commission to their delegates. So as
I have no faith
that Congress is going to do anything. When I read this that we're going to petition Congress, I hate to say this, but I see us with our hat in our hand going to Congress, and frankly, I'm not into that. I'm not into going to Congress at all with my hat in hand saying, will you please do this? Because they've proven beyond at least any of my reasonable doubt, they absolutely are not capable of coming up with a solution.
Well, if you put a gun,
and they're not going to answer.
A lot of people I don't have faith in, but if I put a gun at their head, they'll do it, okay? I mean, that's reality. it's quite possible, you're right, that, you know, if we just had one state, if I just went up there and said, pretty please, Mr. Roy Blunt, would you please support this state repeal amendment? I think it's a really good idea. You know, unless I got a bag full of cash, I ain't going anywhere in Washington, D.C., right? We all know that. But I do know this, too. You get to 33 states that all petition Congress and say, we want this specific amendment proposed. It's not binding. It's not an application for a convention. It just says all 33 of us out here in the grassroots land, we want this amendment. And guess what? We got another state, Missouri, that's gonna join us tomorrow. So if you don't propose this, okay, after that, we're calling a convention and we're gonna ram it down your throat. Now it's very hard for anybody to meet that argument once you get to that critical mass. Then you don't have to say, well, I just hope the convention knows what to do. But we don't know how to answer that. You could not answer the question directly, what are your top three amendments you think will fix this problem? And you don't see a problem with that. You don't have faith in Congress. You sure have faith in that convention. They're going to come up with something. which we don't know what it's going to be, but they're going to come up with something, I guess. How am I supposed to believe in that?
Well, my faith is in a person who's been a constitutional lawyer for 35 years, and he's worked all those years fighting
the
government.
Then here's my suggestion. Ask him for his top three amendments.
Well,
because if you haven't asked him for it. If you got a constitutional lawyer that's got all the answers, that's great. Maybe he could share it with us. Before we call a convention, we'd like to know his three best ideas. Is that unreasonable? What's
no, not at all.
I've
seen some of his ideas, and I think he'd be more than happy to share them with you.
Everybody. Not just me. It's not like me
alone.
Well,
I know, but I mean, to begin with, yep, no question.
I mean, this is the approach that I'm on. Okay, I'm you know, I realize now I'm on yet another approach, because you got the people that say never a convention, it'll be a disaster if we have a convention. No, it won't. We're not going to rewrite the Constitution right now. I mean,
no. Isn't
that going to happen? Okay, that's absurd. Frankly, it's not even close to the conditions that exist in 1787. It shows a deep ignorance of American history and why the founders had to do what they did. And they absolutely tried to reform the Articles before they took that step. They absolutely did try that. And they ran out of options. And there they were, and they rewrote the whole thing and realized, we got fatal flaws in this Articles, man. And we're going to have to do something or the nation will fail. And that's where they were. We are not in that same boat. We don't face a runaway. We do face a potential of a dud convention, I'll tell you that. And that's something that, you know, you apparently are absolutely convinced. I've used this example before, but if we called a convention of the best and brightest doctors and said, let's find a cure for cancer, do you think that convention would find a cure for cancer?
That's a totally different example, but yeah, you're right.
They wouldn't, would they? No, I mean, this is a pretty hard problem to solve, too. You're talking about fixing a constitution. I don't know if the average American, you're right, they just don't understand how far off this constitution we are. But it's very serious. And it's getting worse throughout our lifetimes, people. And we've learned to ignore it, and we are way off this document at this point. We don't see it. We're kind of oblivious to it. You know, we got Republican and Democrat parties. We have elections, blah, blah, blah. Man, oh, man, this thing is in sorry shape. We got an unlimited federal government. We got, you know, out of control all over the place.
Thinking today, just as soon as the president takes his pen in his hand and gets on the phone, every time he says, if Congress won't act, I will. As soon as he says those words, he goes against John Locke, he goes against Montesquieu, he goes against every framer, every founder, and he goes against every president who's followed the Constitution up till now. That's what we've got.
All right, we're going to take a break. With that, we'll be back with Lloyd and Keith Carmichael.
Never invested as much in public education as we should have, because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to whole communities. Once it's everybody's responsibility and not just the household, then we start making better investments.
Believing in never seeing the strings they think bind. Have you joined Missouri Grassroots Coalition yet? The results of the 2012 election proved that the grassroots conservatives need to work harder to make their voices heard in government. The best way for Missouri conservatives to make their voices heard is to join together within the Missouri Grassroots Coalition Network and show our elected that we are a strong, unified, conservative voice in Missouri. Go to the website, MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, and click on the Join tab. Give us your contact information so that we can keep you updated on the latest developments in Jefferson City and beyond. Also, sign up for grass fire alerts so that you can get immediate notifications when we need to call grassroots conservatives together in action. Use the MGC network to help your grassroots organization speak with a louder voice combined with grassroots groups across the state. Together, we can strengthen the conservative voice in Missouri.
Jim Crow climb, come springtime, so let me hear you say.
Lloyd Sloan, champion of the state repeal amendment, and now to a much, much lesser degree of no mo sales tax. And Keith Carmichael, director of the Missouri Coalition of Convention of the States. So, where are we here in this thing? Where we are is we've got several states. Georgia did it, didn't they, Keith?
Yeah, we've got it's House H.R. 1215 passed the Georgia House this week. And so they're the first state to pass in both houses, but they actually have to go to reconciliation. So but there's Alaska, Alabama, Arizona, Florida, New Mexico, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Virginia, West Virginia, all of those are in committee or coming up for votes on one house or the other. So things are moving, and there's, of course, I think the number of people on that I see names of and in Missouri on conventionofstates.com has doubled in the last 30 days. So I would say that if it continues to do that, this is just going to build as it has. We're just in the first few weeks of this. You really stop and look at when Mark Levin wrote his book, when the Convention of States website came online. You know, that's just a few weeks ago, really. And in terms of politics and the way that things move legislatively, it's basically we're in the first few minutes of this thing, the way I look at it.
Okay, and yeah. You do have some sponsors and co-sponsors in the House. You're going to be presenting it to the Missouri State House of Representatives, if I understand, this week, and then you'll start working the Senate side and getting it ready for when that thing crosses over.
Sure, and I don't think we've reiterated this carefully enough. That this is a resolution calling for a convention of the states for the purpose of restraining the scope, the jurisdiction, and the power of the federal government. And it also mentions putting on fiscal restraints as well. So, I mean, that's what it's about, and that's operative language in every state that I've mentioned thus far. Those paragraphs that are in the resolution in every one of these states, basically the same. So they don't go to Congress, and Congress says, "Well, these don't match. They're going to be nearly word for word." And
let me
Rob Nadelson says they don't. Go ahead.
Let me ask a question, just a theoretical, because I'm really not understanding, and there is no, I don't care who says there is no historical perspective for how we limit this thing, because we haven't done this.
Let me answer the question just a little bit. Let's say when you go, we have a number of conventions. We had virtually 11 conventions in the 10 in the years before the founding, and many of those were on specific topics, and they were limited in the call, and they were limited in the commission, and also in the instructions of those people who went, those commissions that went. Now, for them to show up at a commission on a convention, let's say, of the Colorado River Compact, a Colorado River, for example, that's a fairly recent one, but if folks would have showed up at that particular convention and begin to propose things that were not related at all to that call, it's the responsibility of the chairman to simply rule them out of order. And okay. We have examples of things that were given from one convention to another, and if they fall outside the boundaries, they become, at the very most, recommendations for a future convention.
But right now, Keith, we are talking about proposing or actually petitioning the Congress to call a convention, and that's where this wording is structured. So we would be asking the Congress to call a convention specifically for whatever this wording is, and I'm not going to try to repeat it all over
again.
Okay.
Restraining, yeah.
So Congress calls a convention, as did the Congress of the Articles, call
actually,
a convention.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that there were 7 states that had already called for the convention in 1787 before February, when the Congress of the Articles began to take action, and they basically removed the word recommendation, and they were of the opinion that this should be done. So they didn't have the power under the Articles to actually call a convention, but they did comment on them. But there were 7 that had called, and I even named their commissioners before the February of 1787. So this actually, the states, by their own residual power, were able to call this convention.
Right.
In 1787.
The 1787 convention was called by Congress. That's who called it.
And there was a specific...
7 states called for it before Congress had even acted at all on it.
They really didn't until Congress acted on it. After Annapolis, Hamilton and Madison went back to Congress. That's when they said, okay, we're going to try this again, send delegates again. And they suggested the next May in 1787 to convene. And that came up from Congress, came from the U.S. Congress. The Congress at that time under the Articles. I can get you the date of the resolution, too, if you want it.
Sure, I just know that I was just been told, and I was looking for the actual article that in December of 86, several states had already called and named their delegates for that before the February meeting of Congress of the Articles. But
okay,
go ahead with your question. I'm sorry.
But let's go ahead. So 7 states, which are analogous to the to the 34 states we're looking for right now, in percentage, 7 states called for a convention, and the Congress did, in fact, then issue a resolution under which the convention was to be formed. Now, it is our contention, then, at this point, that it's not a runaway convention because 10 states had violated in commissioning their delegates the resolution sent down by Congress and given them carte blanche to go in and write a new constitution. Is that right?
No, the Congress had no power to call a convention, and you go back and look at what they actually said. They couldn't even recommend. They actually had to put the word opinion in there, and I was going to read it here, but I haven't gotten to it yet, but they actually were.
That's fine. So Congress had no power to call a convention. However, today we have Article 5 of the United States Constitution, which says that Congress is empowered to call the convention.
Sure.
Well, we're back to pretty much where I started. We have no history to base our assumption that Congress can limit this convention, because the Congress previously didn't have power to limit the convention, but this Congress does. I mean, my question is, do we have some history to base that on? And the answer is no. I mean, it would be nice to say, here's the handbook that all the delegates have to follow. Well, the question begs itself, who said so?
No, nobody. I mean, I know what you're. I see your point. I was just looking at, in the reference here to answer
the
question.
I can tell you the report, the call by Congress was issued Wednesday, February 21st, 1787. You can Google it, Report of Proceedings in Congress on that day, February 21st, 1787. It's at the Yale Avalon Project. They'll give you the text.
Yeah,
I'm
looking at it.
I believe it is correct what you're saying, that the Articles of Confederation had no provision to do this. So in a sense, it's unauthorized even to do it. Depends on, I mean, they're not really, see, the thing is they're not binding. I mean, frankly, I don't think that's a very important point, just because there was no provision for the Annapolis Convention either. I mean, there's no, and yet at the same time, can Congress assemble, can Congress ask states to get together and do this? Sure. I mean, they're not doing anything substantive. The
quite
real
frankly,
problem is that.
Quite
yeah,
frankly, quite frankly, that Congress there, under the Articles of Confederation, was really nothing more than a almost permanently seated convention of the states. That Congress there had no power to do anything. Every state had veto power.
I have to agree. Yeah, that's true.
Over everything, every single state had veto power over everything, which is why the Articles of Confederation had to go. I mean, so you know, I mean, this Congress was nothing more than a permanently seated convention of the states, really.
Sure. What was interesting is actually the congressional committee of that Congress. It went to a committee in which. And what they had is Dickinson's Annapolis letter was entrusted and moved that Congress strongly recommended the states that they send delegates to a convention that would devise such further provisions as shall render the same adequate in the exigencies of the Union. But at that point, the New York congressional delegates, citing their instructions, objected. See, they didn't have instructions that allowed them to do that. They moved to postpone the committee report and offered a resolution by which Congress would recommend to the states a convention for the purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. Their insistence on that wording confirms that people understood that the convention recommended by the delegates at Annapolis, endorsed by seven states and promoted by the congressional committee, was not limited to proposing changes in the articles. In other words, they understood that. And so...
Here's the exact wording. I think we're reading from the same place. It's recommended to the states that they send representatives for the purpose, this is a direct quote, for the purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and perpetual union between the United States of America. That was the purpose of the convention.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. I don't really care what's in that resolution. What really matters is the articles could not be changed, period, without unanimous consent of every state. We adopted the Constitution without that. We broke
well, actually, what happened was when Congress took that, they sent out two things. To the legislatures, they sent out two things. They sent out a proposal for changing the way it was adopted. And those states, even Rhode Island, which didn't later on, you know, ratify the Constitution, even Rhode Island voted, well, it was a unanimous vote to change the process. And
no, that's not true.
Public school textbooks that teach the opposite, but Michael Ferris says, if you look at the original. What's that?
I got us, you know, give me the date Rhode Island amended the article so that it didn't have to be unanimous.
When they called the,
what was that date?
Whenever they called the convention
in Rhode Island, that, they didn't call their convention until after. They never ratified the Constitution until after the thing had already gone into effect. Rhode Island didn't join until 1791.
And so boycotted the convention.
That Rhode Island approved the change. They didn't approve any change. Not before it went into effect. They joined later.
Here's
but
my
they
point.
Didn't call, they didn't call a convention. They didn't do it.
Here's my only point. My only point is this. Lloyd read verbatim the call from Congress. Okay? So with this call from Congress to revise the Articles of Confederation, some states we can argue yes or no. 10 states we can argue yes or no. I happen to argue yes. Sent their delegates unfettered to Philadelphia. And I believe that I have a hard time with this, Keith, that with something as vague as what we're proposing, even coming from the Congress as the commission of the state gathering, that you can say historically the states can't do whatever they damn well please once they get there. I mean, once the states join at the convention site, it's hard to historically look at the Constitutional Convention and say they don't become a power unto themselves.
Well, that whole philosophy became evident in the state of Illinois. In the state convention of Illinois, there's two that and would be the closest thing that you can call a runaway convention that's in history. There's one in New York, and there's the two in Illinois. But they actually came up with this idea of convention of the convention being sovereign. It's strange that you mention that, because that's the doctrine that they used in order to take control of the convention in the state of Illinois, and go completely off. But what's interesting is the citizenry, after that happened, the citizenry reelected, they cleaned house, and they repudiated everything that convention had done, because it was obvious they had gone off the rails as a state convention. Now, we're talking about a process in which the delegates are individual states, and we're talking
Correct.
About we'd like to have the perfect scenario in which we can control this, but what controls it is actually the process itself. Someone says, "Well, I would love for this to be all packaged up where it can be controlled." Well, the problem with that is you might be able to influence your state delegates, and you can select your state delegates, but you have absolutely nothing to say with the sovereign state of the state of New Mexico and the sovereign state of New Jersey or the sovereign state of Nebraska. Those people are sovereign, and they will send their own commissioners with their own instructions. And frankly, the fact that you can't control them is not a bad thing.
I think I've been saying that
That's
since the very
beginning.
That's a good
thing, because nobody else can control them either.
I think I've been saying that since the very beginning, Lloyd, or Keith, and having heard you say that makes me want to go back to the point of, with something as vague as to limit the federal government, you have virtually no control over what commission those states send their delegates to the convention to do. So,
well, you're right.
So
but obviously, if they voted as a state,
right,
to call for a convention for the purpose of limiting the jurisdiction, scope, and power of the federal government, they're not going to turn around and instruct their delegates to repeal the Second Amendment, for example.
Let's back up a little bit, okay? Mm-hmm. Because the only thing that we're hanging this on historically is a bunch of states that were commissioned by a congressional resolution, which is what we're looking for, a congressional call to convention.
Well, that's not what commissions them. The individual states commission them.
Okay. We're looking for Congress. We're looking for 34 states to petition Congress to issue a call to convention. There is a time when 7 states petitioned Congress to issue a call to convention, and the Congress did that. We're asking for Congress to specifically state that we're going to have a convention for the purpose of limiting the federal government scope, finding fiscal, blah, blah, for the specific purpose of limiting the federal government, because that's what the states petitioned the Congress to call a convention for. And we look back at history and we see a Congress doing what the states asked and issuing a call to convention to modify the Articles of Confederation to make them work for all exigent circumstances. And now we're saying that the states would not send their delegates to the convention with a commission to do anything other than that, when we look back at the same history and say, oh, but it wasn't a runaway convention because 10 of the 13 states sent their delegates to Philadelphia with a commission to do other than what the Congress told them to do.
Congress didn't have the power to tell them to do anything. All they can
okay.
do, if you go back and examine the actual wording, it says
is it or,
opinion.
Is it or
opinion.
Is it not? Is it or is it not our contention that the Congress doesn't have the power to limit the states? Can Congress say, okay, you can only pass these 2 amendments and nothing else?
Obviously not, no.
Okay.
No, they become a ministerial. Their job is strictly ministerial. And
so,
and folks
given,
say, well, what happens if they don't do their ministerial duty?
So
then
given
you think in terms of sovereign states, we don't really need their permission to have a convention.
Right. So
it's
given,
almost like we're courtesy.
So given the only example we have in American history of a successful convention, the
but
one in Philadelphia.
Not really true,
well,
that's
okay.
not really true.
Given the successful convention that gave us the most stable government that the world has seen, mm-hmm. being attended by states that sent delegates to the convention with commissions to do other than what they had asked Congress to call the convention for, and with commissions to do other than what the Congress called the convention for, how do we feel that we can control the convention by controlling what we ask Congress to call the convention for and what Congress calls the convention for? Are you following me?
A little bit.
That was a little roundabout, but what I'm saying is right now we're at the point where 34 states are going to make an analogous petition to Congress for a limited convention. 7 states made an analogous petition to Congress for a limited convention. Congress...
You can't hardly put the two Congresses together because obviously we have Article 5, which gives them the power to do that, and they didn't have the power to do that.
States have the power to do it whether or not the Congress does it or not. I mean, we've just said that. Let's just say Congress doesn't have the power to decide not to do it. Okay, so Congress issues this resolution just as that Congress issued a resolution, and 10 states then sent delegates commissioned, we claim, to do more than or other than the resolution that they had asked the Congress for and that the Congress had issued. Now,
the two aren't, you can't literally lay the two side by side and make that comparison, because it's just not a good example.
Okay, because states today aren't sovereign, and those states were?
Well, no, because the Congress at that time could only give an opinion. They didn't have the power. There was no provision for them to do anything.
Do they now?
What they did is almost agree with what the committee.
You're suggesting, and I agree 100% with you, that Congress had no power to control what the state sent delegates to Philadelphia to do. Now, I contend that this Congress has no power to control what states send delegates to Mount Vernon to do. So it is exactly analogous, I mean, except for the fact that the Constitution dictates to the Congress that they will issue this proclamation, this call for convention, when 34 states apply. I mean,
right.
Congress doesn't even have the power not to do it, technically.
Well, it is new ground, and that is definitely the case.
Okay,
yeah,
I agree. It is new ground, and that is definitely the case, and that is definitely why I contend you can't say, okay, here's the handbook all the delegates are going to use.
I would argue, we're not under the Articles anymore. Unless we can get a candid discussion that, in fact, the 1787 violated the Articles, then we really can't make the argument I'm making now. But I would say that, yes, the founders did go off the Articles because they changed the ratification process itself. The Articles did require unanimous consent to change anything. And they abandoned that and said, no, it's going to be 9 out of 13. And that's a fundamental change. The comparable thing today would be, suppose your convention meets and they say, I'm going to rewrite the whole Constitution. We think this thing's busted. Here's our new one. And our ratification, we're going to put this to a vote of the entire American people, one giant vote. Now, they just broke the Constitution. You put that to a vote and you have violated
it. They've already violated it.
That's correct. And there is no provision in Article 5 to do that. The Article 5 provision specifically states in the Constitution itself that the states can convene in order to propose amendments. There is no provision to change anything else, just to propose amendments. And they can propose whatever amendments they want. That's my reading of it. And
right.
I would argue that, yeah, they can do whatever they want to do as far as proposing amendments. Go for it, guys. Do whatever you want. But that's all you can do. You have to understand that the 1787 convention changed the rules of the game. It is a revolution. And it was called a revolution by George Washington. It was recognized as such by Madison in the Federalist Papers. And he basically, I mean, if you read the Federalist Papers, I think it's number 40, he basically says, there's an issue whether or not the convention violated its commission and violated its charter. And what he says is, let's focus on the substantive issue. Let's not worry. Maybe they did and maybe they didn't, and they probably did. Okay. So he's kind of saying, yeah, there's a good chance that we had no choice. He's saying, we were a doctor. We were given a problem. We believe this was the only way we could solve it. We took it to the American people and said, do what you want. But Rhode Island was absolutely adamant they weren't going to change anything.
I'll send you this. And you know how attorneys will make arguments, and this attorney has made an argument, and I'll send you the argument. He says that Congress approved both recommendations, and however, he did not send the document to state conventions. They sent the recommendation for the new process to the state legislatures instead. And here's the argument as an attorney that he's made.
I'm specifically referring to Rhode Island.
I know. All 13 state legislatures approved the new process by calling conventions in their states. In other words, their
action. Rhode Island did not call a convention. Yeah, he's wrong. Rhode Island did not call a convention.
That's what I said. It's an argument by an attorney, and everybody has a take on it.
It's a factual matter. So here's what happened in Rhode Island. In fact, I'm quoting right now from a Wisconsin history department, but if you Google the things I'm mentioning now, you will find this is accurate, I believe. They have no axe to grind. It's because the University of Wisconsin Department of History, I have the link. I actually sent it to Dave Court, okay? So he's got it. I'm quoting, all of the states complied except Rhode Island. Over the next 2 years, the state legislature repeatedly rejected the call for such a convention. Instead, on the 1st of March, 1788, they sent it to a statewide referendum where it was rejected 90 to 10. Okay? Rhode Island at no time agreed to any change to the Articles of Confederation. Never. And what they did was eventually adopt the Constitution 2 years later after it had already gone into effect.
How did they do that?
That's when they called their convention. That's when they
So
did
what
it.
His argument is,
but the Constitution
by calling
was already
the convention,
in
effect. That's what he was saying. Yeah, that's what his
they
argument was.
They didn't call a convention until after the Constitution was in effect.
Well, it was
okay.
It was in effect
that's
for
right.
all the states who came aboard, but it wasn't in effect
breaking,
for them until they came aboard.
Breaking. All that proves is he agreed. They broke the Articles. I agree the Constitution was in effect. What he's failing to understand is the Articles were not followed in that process.
Mm-hmm.
Rhode Island never did call that convention until after the Constitution was in effect. They ignored that. They ignored it. They said, and I agree they should ignore it. You're going to stop everybody? You're going to stop 12 other states because Rhode Island didn't want to go along? The Articles themselves were dangerously flawed. They required unanimity. That's why the founders replaced the Articles.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you would just amend them. You know, why don't you just say, well, you know, we're going to have this convention. We're going to change the way the Articles are amended. We don't want to, it doesn't have to be unanimous. We're just going to do it. That would also be a revolution. I mean, the amending process itself is one of the key processes in the Constitution. It really is. I mean, that's
sure.
your true root of sovereignty.
We talked today about you know, there's people fighting in Europe right now for their liberty, and this point was made really by Mark Levin on his February 12th show on marklevinshow.com. You can go back and listen to the whole thing. It's all about Article 5. But he makes the point by every society has to struggle, and they have two choices. They can be subjects, or they can have a revolution. And the beauty what the framers did is they said, here, we're going to give you a recourse. We're going to give you an option. We're going to give you door number three where you can change this without bloodshed. But by being afraid to use it gives us a constitution without it. And so we're no better than if we don't use this Article 5, then we have a constitution without it. And we're no better than those folks over there in Europe. We're either going to have to be subjects or we're going to have to fight.
Well,
okay.
What I'm hearing you say with that is you're actually admitting this convention is a revolutionary act. You know, because this is our resort to that revolution. Am I interpreting that correctly? That, you know, because we're saying this is the plenary power of the people needing.
Well, the truth, though, is that what makes it different than a revolution is that this is in the Constitution, and
I agree.
It's a powderless revolution. It is a revolution,
yeah,
just the same.
Powderless revolution, of course.
I don't view it as revolutionary as long as they follow the Constitution and all they do is propose amendment. Then I don't view it as revolutionary. But it was revolutionary to abandon the Articles at that time. And so what scares me is when I hear Convention of States people say, no, 1787 wasn't revolutionary. Do you have the same model in mind for now? That you're just going to ignore the amending process, ignore what's in there, and just say, well, whatever that convention decides, that's what we're going to do.
Hold on. We're going to take a break, and then we got to come back, and we got to say goodnight. I'm sorry, folks, but I have a clock here that I have to live with.
Have you joined Missouri Grassroots? No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
They told me that you had gone totally insane, and that your methods were unsound. Are my methods unsound? I didn't see any methods.
I'm Dave, and we're back one more time. We've got about 4 minutes left, so it's going to be last words for everybody. Keith Carmichael, director of the Missouri Coalition of the COS. You're welcome here anytime, Keith. We always love talking to you. I like the good work you're doing. Keith has got something moving in the House of Representatives now. They're working on the Senate in Missouri to get a resolution together. It's a long road, though, isn't it, Keith?
It is, but you know it's going to happen. I talked to a young couple today, and they had three kids, and one was really small. And I said, you know, this is not about us. It's about them. I said, one of these days, she's going to have a little one. Just might look just like she does today. And maybe, you know, this is not about us. This is about our kids and our kids' kids and on and the future generations. We owe it to them to stop what we're doing and – you know, people will do almost anything for their kids today. They'll drive anywhere and do anything. We just need to stop and begin to plan a strategy that has a solution as big as the problem, and that's Convention of the States.
Absolutely. Convention of the States. Say the website, Keith.
ConventionOfStates.com.
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 Not states, not the. There's no the in there.
That's correct. You'll get lost if you fall down there.
ConventionOfStates.com. Okay, Keith, thanks. Call back anytime. We always love having you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Lloyd, you're going to be with us tomorrow night, and we're going to talk more specifically about the state repeal amendment, which I have started calling the state powers amendment. And we're going to talk about some evolutions that it has gone through, some revisions and how those things are being accepted and talked about. And we'll talk about some other things, as you and I always do when we talk.
Sure. Yep, that sounds good. Yep.
Thanks for coming, Lloyd. Appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
Good night, thank you.
Bye.
Okay, folks. One thing, regardless of what parallels you can or cannot draw between what's going on now and what went on back in Philadelphia, one thing is absolutely certain. We are at a level of urgency here that cannot be denied. We're the Constitution is gone. And I agree with both Lloyd and Keith in one specific way, and that is nothing is not an option anymore. And this Convention of the States, I mean, we need to spend the next however many years it is, talking about this thing, because we can't afford to fail. Failure at this point is doom. Is the end. Once we get this thing rolling, failing is the last straw. We'll be back tomorrow night with Lloyd, and we're going to talk about the SRA a little bit more. And I'll look forward to seeing and hearing from all of you then. Until then, thanks for tuning in. This is Dave. It's been the Hour of Truth. Good night.
There are so many contradictions in all these messages we send. Keep asking, how do I get out of here? Where do I fit in?